unless you've experienced it yourself, it's hard to know how poverty affects a person's daily life. There is a way, though, to give folks a new perspective on what it's like, struggling to make ends meet. Today, we learn how poverty simulations are helping people understand the plight of the poor, and we find out why that lesson is so important to some local healthcare students. Then, the reckoning has reached Topeka. Kind of. Last week, a new set of recommendations was announced to help prevent and combat harassment in the Kansas legislature. We'll meet someone with a hand in crafting those recommendations and try to find out what their effects might be. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. What's it like to live below the poverty line? Maybe some of us know from experience, but many of us can't even begin to answer that question, even many whose work involves serving and caring for the community's poorest. One solution to that problem? Poverty simulators, exercises that give those not living in poverty a taste by forcing them to confront the hard choices and the harsh realities of living on the edge. Joining us to tell us more about that today are Mary Bifolco. She is Poverty Simulation Manager with the Missouri Community Action Network. That's a statewide organization providing services for low-income people. Mary, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And also Dr. Stephanie Ellison. She's an Associate Dean at the UMKC School of Medicine, and she directs a program like this for students who are preparing to be doctors and nurses and dentists and pharmacists on Hospital Hill. Dr. Ellison, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I should say we're no relation, but I'm glad to meet her. In a few minutes, we'll talk with someone who participated in one of these programs. But first, Mary Bifolco, let me ask you, what is a poverty simulation?
Yeah, so a poverty simulation is an immersive participatory educational experience. So a bird's eye view, there's 26 family profiles. Everyone who walks in gets a new identity. And this outlines their name, their income, their bills, and they're forced to interact with resources around the room. Those represent the for-profit, not-for-profit, and governmental organizations present in the real world. And their main goal in these four simulated weeks, which are 15 minutes apiece, is to maintain their shelter, pay all their bills.
And so it sounds like it takes quite a few people to put this on.
It surely does. So you need at least about 18 to 25 people to work those resource tables around the room, and you need at least two facilitators to help put it on.
How long does something like this last?
So those weeks are the bulk of the simulation. That's an hour long to do to meet those objectives of maintaining your shelter and going through the month. But there's also 30 minutes beforehand where we give people poverty statistics in order to really relay the gravity of this situation and make sure they enter it with the proper attitude and respect. And then afterwards, there's anywhere from a 30-minute to hour-long debrief where we process together and peers can challenge their beliefs.
So give me an example of, an identity, one of these family profiles. You walk in, you're handed a piece of paper, I guess, that says this is who you are. Give me an example.
Yeah, there's a wide range of family situations. Some of these families do, in fact, fall below the poverty line, but many of them are kind of flirting with falling beneath it. Right?
On the edge.
On the edge. Thank you.
Yeah.
So, for example, there's a family, the Aber family. It's the first one. The husband is a computer programmer who's lost his job. So they used to have an income of about $40,000 a month that would feed this family of five. And now he's been unemployed for 2 months, and they're trying to make ends meet with their unemployment.
So let me ask you, Dr. Ellison, how did the medical professional schools on Hospital Hill come to be involved with this program? Why is this something that students studying for health professions would be involved with?
That's a great question. I'm in charge in my role for interprofessional education for the health professional programs at UMKC. Mm-hmm. And we have a very rich curriculum in interprofessional education. We have a first and second activity that bring interprofessional students together on teams to solve problems and to take care of patients. And we looked into the Missouri Community Action Network poverty simulation kit and found that it ideally suited the training needs of our professionals for this program and that it highlighted a lot of population health issues that we're trying to teach our students at this time in the curriculum. In addition, our students like to be engaged in very real activities and simulations. And so it also suited what our students were asking for in terms of education.
Well, and I know you're the Associate Dean for Learning Initiatives, which implies to me that there's more than just this that gets students sort of out of the books, out of the hospitals, too. Some people might think that's what they want their doctors to be studying. Why is something like this important?
What's nice about this is it enhances those activities you already mentioned. There is a need to be in the classroom. There is a need to be with patients. But because of population health, we felt this was ideally suited for our patients, or for our, rather our students, to understand what it's like for patients. We teach a lot of patient-centeredness, but there's no better way to learn about what a patient's going through than in a simulation where they get to experience the day-to-day issues and problems that they will need to solve as professionals in practice.
At UMKC and the various schools that are part of this program, how many of the students are coming from a background where they've had any exposure in their own lives to poverty?
I've talked a little to our student affairs leadership. I don't know the actual number for that, but I have, as a blessing of providing this poverty simulation, had at least three opportunities where students have come forward and thanked us for this simulation, that they were living in poverty, they didn't feel like they could talk about it, and that it was a very realistic way to teach professionals about meeting the needs of patients living in poverty. So I don't have an actual number for you, but I do know that students have... Yeah, it is. It is.
Yeah, but a lot who maybe this is the first time they've considered some of these questions, it sounds like.
Yes. And a lot of that debriefing that Mary mentioned at the end was an opportunity for students to really understand poverty and then to look inside themselves and see and understand the barriers. And they were very surprised about what our patients are going through and steps that they could take as a nurse, a dentist, a physician, a pharmacist, a social worker, to really enhance meeting the health needs of our patients by understanding those struggles.
That's Stephanie Ellison. She's an associate dean at the UMKC School of Medicine. We're also talking with Mary Bifulco from the Missouri Community Action Network about poverty simulations. And we want to talk with one of the students who was involved in, and has been involved in several times, these poverty simulations at UMKC. Jordan Deuce is a fourth-year medical student. Hi, Jordan.
Hi.
You've not only been a participant, you've now helped as a facilitator. You've been one of those volunteers we talked about. How many of these have you done altogether?
I have done 9, I believe.
And what is that like to go through this experience?
The first time I went through last year was before I had a lot of patient contact. And so then this year, coming back and being facilitator, it was easier to see how impactful it is for us. And then as a participant, I got to see how difficult it is for our patients.
Yeah, and as a fourth-year student, you're seeing patients now, right?
Yes.
So how does this connect with real life, with the lives of the people that you're now serving as a medical student?
I think it has helped my patient care because I can understand my patients and I take the time to learn about their personal lives or struggles they face rather than just dealing with their medical issues.
So I asked Mary a moment ago to tell us about one family profile that in the program. Can you recall a specific identity that you've been given as an example that sort of was part of this experience of opening your eyes and experiencing some things?
I was the dad in my family. I had 2 kids. I was out of work, and my wife was out of work. And so one of my kids was pregnant, and the neighbor next door was the one who got her pregnant. And so we had to deal with the families. So we actually joined families kind of together, so we'd have babysitters for our kids. Huh. My wife went and got a job, and then I did all the bill paying. And we almost got evicted. We made it by 5 seconds in the simulation.
Wow.
But we had to work together with the other family, otherwise we wouldn't have made it.
It's a higher level of detail than I realized. You had to make a significant number of complicated decisions.
Yes, you have to make decisions fast, and this exercise forces you to work with people from different professions. I knew one person that was in my family, and another was from the pharmacy school, and I met her a few times. And so that kind of helped us be cohesive, but it's a really great way to teach us to admit when you don't know what you need to do and ask for help.
We'd love to hear from our listeners. What questions do you have about poverty simulations? Have you ever participated in one? What difference would this make in the communities that you are a part of? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888 with your comments or questions for our guests today. Mary Bifulco, tell us a little about the history of this. Missouri Community Action didn't invent this idea, right?
Right. The poverty simulation actually has a really rich history before Missouri Community Action got a hold of it. So it was developed by a group called ROWL, which stands for Reform Organization of Welfare. This is an organization that was established in 1972 in St. Louis, and it's a faith-based organization. So a couple of reverends dreamed up the poverty simulation because ROWL's mission is really to advocate for the poor by working for legislative and administrative changes to the welfare system. Mm-hmm. And they thought, in order to do this work, we really need to rally some political will. And so the poverty simulation developed by Reverend Don Barnes and Mary Webster was the way to do that. And it was quite successful. They toured the country giving this poverty simulation, and the organization did disband in the early 2000s, and ROWL had a relationship with Missouri CAN, so it was a really natural fit for us to buy the rights to this curriculum, and we readapted it so that it would reflect the contemporary realities of community action clients.
Well, I wondered how often this has to be updated. I mean, the fact is economic environment is changing. People in different communities are faced with different issues, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So that was in 2002 that we did that first initial update. It's been updated about every 5 years since. The most recent update was in 2012, and every year we have to update statistics because that federal poverty threshold is always changing. But a lot of the macro level stuff like Department of Social Services and the other resources, those are really static.
So who does this besides the interprofessional education program at UMKC? What kinds of organizations sign up for these?
We see a lot of interest from educational institutions, but not just universities, but also K through 12 schools. That's our other biggest group. Districts are really interested in using the poverty simulation to train new teachers, so as part of professional development.
And do these tend to be districts that have a lot of poverty within them, or are they trying to open eyes of districts that might be regarded as more affluent or more comfortable?
I think there's great interest from both. The districts that have a lot of students that are in poverty find it really necessary to engage teachers in that conversation. And even in school districts that are generally wealthy, there's always children that are low income in almost every school district. And so I think districts are acknowledging that it's a crucial conversation.
Let's take a call at 816-235-2888 from Debbie in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Debbie.
Hi there. I just wanted to say I was involved in a poverty simulation a couple of years ago. I was actually the pawn shop owner, and I would like to recommend that every single member holder of public office has to do a poverty simulation from local government all the way to DC, because it shows people the real what Main Street is doing, and it's invaluable. And I could see on the faces of people from the beginning to the end that they got it. It wasn't the same as real life, but it's enough to see that they got it.
Thanks so much for the call. Appreciate it. Let me ask you, Stephanie Ellison, the reality is that these experiences may feel foreign, may feel unfamiliar to the participants, and yet they are all around them. How much are you able to sort of take the simulation and apply it to real situations that people are facing outside of the game, of the exercise?
Yes. It is a simulation, but it is so well designed that it creates this feeling of chaos when you're completing the month in poverty. I trained by completing the simulation as a facilitator in order to train and then implement it. And the feeling of chaos and stress and this feeling of trying to navigate something that you can't solve very easily is very real. And I do a lot of simulation in emergency medicine. I'm an emergency physician at Truman Medical Center. And I really felt that this simulation impressed me with the realistic lives that you have to portray and the challenges that they go through that I learn something every time that we put these poverty simulations on. And so I think it's invaluable for, I agree with the caller, for everyone to get involved and to go through this simulation, because you learn a lot about yourself as well.
Yeah. Jordan, you said that you've now made the transition to being one of the people behind the tables. You're staffing the stations now. What sorts of roles have you had to play in the simulator?
I, like the caller, actually play the pawnbroker a lot of the time. I've also been the banker.
And what goes into playing the pawnbroker? Like, what's going through the mind of that person?
So for being the pawnbroker, you kind of, there's not many rules set up for you. You can buy people's goods for however much you want and sell them back for however much you want. So when I was playing it, I would always try to get the students to pretend that these little cards of paper were actually their real things and make them give me like a memory about it or something. So they had to think about that these in real life, people are selling things that are really valuable to them. In the simulation, it's just a piece of paper, but in real life, they're valuable and meaningful. And so I would make them think about it. And if they would just be like, I just want to sell my TV, I'd be like, I'll give you like $2. So I made them like think about real life situations.
You know, I do have to ask, I mean, is there ever pushback from this this idea of simulating people's poverty with people who are not really poor? Do you ever face sort of the charge that this is insensitive, that you're sort of dressing up and playing poor when there are people really struggling, Mary?
Yeah, I think that's a great question that we have to ask ourselves at Missouri Can, because it's a valid pushback. And I think that there are other poverty simulations that do get a lot more pushback than ours, because we do set up the parameters on ours so clearly. We start by saying, you know, this isn't actually poverty. This is a way for folks who really have no clue to first kind of pinpoint their own ignorance. And that's really where we're coming from. And I think that also, a lot of poverty education does put the onus on people in poverty to become poster children and to speak from their own experience, and that can be really taxing. Whereas the poverty simulation does shift the onus of learning onto the learner. And so I think that there is some real benefits to that, in that people in poverty can work those resource stations around, and they do have a really educational role. I've had one volunteer share with me, she was working a table and she said, you know, I'm disabled and I can't show up to work every day, but I can come to this simulation when I feel like it and feel like I really have a purpose and I'm doing some public good by sharing my story and educating people. So I think it gives folks in poverty the avenue to share their story if they want to. But even if they don't, learning is still taking place.
And at any given point, how many of these are going on in a week or a month? Do you know?
I wish I knew. I really do wish I knew. But there are, I think, about 1,300 kits across the nation and even the world. So once people purchase a kit, they don't have to tell me when they do a simulation.
Right. Does your organization actually still put them on if they haven't? Not to people who've purchased a kit. Do you actually offer this? Is it something that people can come sign up for?
Yeah. So a lot of folks that have kits are able to put on this simulation for other organizations. Mm-hmm. And if folks in Kansas City want to have a simulation put on for their organization, the Community Action Agency of Greater Kansas City is a great resource. They're happy to host one for you and really do all the heavy lifting.
Let me ask you, Stephanie, what kind of resources did this require of the university? Obviously, universities have some resources to devote to this sort of thing. What all went into it? How hard was it to pull together and how expensive?
Thanks for asking. The kit itself was something that the university paid for and a 2-day training that my colleague and I attended so that we could train the trainers, for example. So we completed the poverty simulation once we purchased the kit, and then they taught us the skills we needed to put on the poverty simulation. In our interprofessional education program, there are actually a number of faculty that have contributed to this very rich curriculum. The poverty simulation is part of it, but I'm proud to announce about 150 faculty and staff assist us with volunteer time in order to pull this off. And so as an example, just the poverty simulation, the third of our major activities, Took us 98 faculty and staff and volunteer time and over 50 hours to both plan and execute 5 poverty simulations for 400 professional students at our UMKC professional schools.
Jordan, one of the points that Mary made is that a lot of this, the learning comes in the debriefing time afterward, that there's this time spent after the walk around. What do you recall from your debriefing times having gone through the simulation? What were questions that have really stuck with you or conversations?
I always enjoy the conversations we have about the resources that are open to even our students, knowing that peers around us face poverty and having an open discussion about the resources available and also those in Kansas City that we can get involved with.
Like what's an example of that kind of resource?
Like we have the Rue Pantry here. We always talk about harvesters, Kansas City Mission. I've done some volunteer work there. There's all different things. There's some dentistry, and then we have a Sojourner's Clinic downtown that the medical school is a big part of, and now pharmacy school has joined us there as well.
The Rue Pantry is a food pantry that serves folks who might be hungry in the UMKC community.
Yes.
Yeah. Mary, I guess another question I have, a lot of people, we think of simulators, I think of like a flight simulator, which is this sort of high-tech experience, and what you've described is pretty low-tech. It's
yes.
People talking to each other with pieces of paper and tables. Is there a place for technology in something like this? Are there simulations being explored that would ratchet up the tech level of this, or is that not even necessary?
Well, the question that we get most often with the poverty simulation is, why don't we have debit cards to make the money transactions electronic? But that's very intentional that we're low tech, because the truth is that a lot of low income folks don't have bank accounts, don't have access to debit or credit cards. And that's a lot of the frustration of the poverty simulation. So it is low tech by design. There are other poverty simulations that you can find online. I know there's one called spent.org, and it poses some of the same questions, and you make those decisions by multiple choice online. But I think the real visceral experience is lost.
Stephanie Ellison, where does this go for UMKC? Is this program just going to continue, or are there other ways that you're trying to take this experience further?
So this is built into our interprofessional education program for 10 different programs at UMKC. And this is only the third event that we have. Our second event is actually a small group case-based opportunity to learn about Kansas City resources. And so within the month, students then go on and complete the poverty simulation to really engage personally and troubleshoot how to reach out to those resources in that visceral way that Mary mentioned, that you're actively trying to live this life and solve these problems. It's concluded with that rich debriefing we spoke of, and then we ask our professional students, we give them a call to service. And we say, this serves as training for you as a professional student. And we ask that you go out and engage yourself in a real way, even partner with another professional student, to go out into the Kansas City community and use the skills we've given you to build service into your profession now as a professional student and in the future when you're practicing as a professional in the healthcare field to solve real problems for your patients.
Jordan Deuce, what kind of medicine do you plan to practice?
At this point, I'm kind of early in my career, but I really do enjoy emergency medicine because of the diverse population that we see.
And how will you be a different kind of ER physician or whatever you pursue as a result of being through these programs?
I think this event and all the events give you more a holistic view of your patients. You don't just focus on the medicine anymore. You focus on their personal lives, their family, and finding resources for them that they're actually able to connect. I may be able to give somebody a resource, but if they can't get transportation to get there, then it might not be the best resource for them. So it helps me think more globally.
That's Jordan Deuce. She's a fourth-year medical student at UMKC. We also have been joined by Dr. Stephanie Ellison, who's an associate dean at the UMKC Medical School, and Mary Bifulco, who is a poverty simulation manager with the Missouri Community Action Network. Thanks to all of you for being with us to talk about poverty simulations today. Thanks.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
It's really good to have you. When we come back, we're going to take a break, and then we'll take a look at the Kansas State House and the way a local group is helping lawmakers confront what some call a culture of sexual harassment. Stay with us. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. And welcome back to KCUR's Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we talked about recent changes in the law in Missouri that lift the veil between adoptees and the identities of their birth parents. We also had a discussion about the importance of identification. You can find those conversations and more at kcur.org/up-to-date. On Monday's program, Steve Kraske's back. He's joined by psychologist Wes Crenshaw and a panel of young women who will talk with us about their experiences with consent and harassment. Harassment is one of the things we're talking about today. One of the big stories of 2017 was something of a revolution in talking about sexual harassment and misconduct. Victims of harassment in various forms across the country from all walks of life spoke out and raised issues, and institutions sought ways to confront the problem, many of them for the first time. State houses were not exempt from that conversation. In fact, Missouri went through a highly publicized soul-searching a few years ago about a culture of harassment at the Capitol. Now, in the last few months, reports have emerged that interns and other young women in the Kansas State House have experienced sexual advances and lewd comments from lawmakers as well. So, legislative leaders there are doing something about it. They've called in the Women's Foundation, a Kansas City-based group led by our guest today, Wendy Doyle, and she's here to tell us how you try to solve a problem like this. Wendy, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be with you.
It's great to be with you. And flesh this out for us a little bit. When the phone call comes from Topeka that says, we've got a problem. What does that call sound like? What do they say to you?
So they reached out to us and learned about what we had done in Missouri, and as a result of that, asked us if we would be a resource to them in their work to look at coming up with some solutions for harassment. So of course we accepted the invitation to do so.
What goes into that? Is it a matter of a conversation? Do you bring a whole team?
Yes. So, Senator Wagle specifically, Senator Susan Wagle from Wichita reached out to us and asked us to be that resource. And so the first steps that we did is accept the opportunity in front of the Legislative Council Committee, and then we began our work. And that acceptance happened in late October. And we had a deliverable to come back to them with recommendations on December 29th. So we had to quickly get busy. So first and foremost, what we did is began an evaluation of their current policies, and it had been identified through that work about 23 years since the policies had been updated, so a great place to start.
Well, in 23 years, it seems like an awfully long time in the societal understanding of sexual harassment and misconduct.
Absolutely, and you think about 23 years ago and fast-forwarding.
23 days seems like a long time lately.
Exactly. So a lot has happened. And to change the workplace culture, so a great place to start. So that work has begun. It will continue to take some time to update those policies. So that was a starting point.
You know, one of the reasons they called you is that the Women's Foundation was involved in Missouri a few years ago addressing some similar questions, right?
Absolutely. Current Speaker Todd Richardson's leadership, he reached out to us. He made a real commitment early in his tenure to really look at changing the culture there and reducing harassment. So he reached out to the Women's Foundation. We worked collaboratively with him and his team to look at changing the harassment policies in the State House, and that has proven to be successful. So with that work, we're looking to bring the best practices to Kansas, too.
I know it's impossible to generalize, but how similar are the situations that you encountered when you first ventured to Jefferson City with what you encountered in Topeka?
I would say very comparable, very similar. Lots of what was happening there of coming forward with victims reporting the harassment. Similar activity has happened in the state capital in Kansas, too.
Yeah. Is there a reason, do you think, that speculate for me, is there a reason that state capitals are particularly vulnerable to these kinds of problems?
You know, I'm not sure if it is specifically state capitals. I think that it is really, I think what we've uncovered, what we all are seeing nationwide is just that this is a deep systemic issue. But it is, I think, more prevalent when you are an elected official and that you are very much in the public eye, that these opportunities, I think it becomes more forefront because of that public face that these elected officials have.
And all the more so, I suppose, in light of the hashtag MeToo revelations of the past few months. Must have been an interesting environment to be doing this work in as all of that was coming out so publicly.
Absolutely. And it was really, you know, side by side that this was unfolding. So we were pleased that we could be a resource at this moment in time for the State House. Absolutely.
So let's get back to Topeka and sort of dig in a little bit. Prior to your work there, what did you find was being done already? Was there training? Was there orientation to these issues?
Not really. I think that's, you know, the benefit and the beauty of this work is that it's really creating a starting point for them. I think that it's important as we presented the recommendations that we identify that this is a long-term strategy. There's some things, small things that could be done immediately, but this is to change a culture and to change the workplace is going to be, you know, long-term, could be even be years before, you know, all of the recommendations are, if they are accepted, put into place. So I think that's, you know, important to make note of. So really we started with, you know, just a very basic, you know, starting reviewing the policies, and not a lot of infrastructure was put into place. So lots of opportunity for Kansas.
Does the Kansas legislature face any particularly unique challenges more than any other company or organization that you might work with?
No, not you know, especially I think, you know, for us, for Women's Foundation, you know, a real motivation is trying to ensure that the interns in particular are protected and have the policies and procedures in place. It's important that young people get a healthy start on their career. And so we want to make sure that it is right and a positive experience for them. So that's a real motivation for us to jump in.
So you did make a series of recommendations. Those came out the last week of December. You met your deadline. Can we talk through those a little bit, starting with the ethics and workplace culture recommendations?
Absolutely. So there are several things under that specific category. Again, looking at a non-fraternization policy for all interns, legislative staff, and lobbyists. And so really what that is, really, we are recommending, again, it is up to the state house to actually adopt these. So I want to be clear about that. But, you know, encouraging that we keep things professional. Mm-hmm. And having professional relationships. And so that's important. That was an important policy for us to bring forward under the ethics and workplace culture. Also, banning gift giving to interns was important to make note. So again, taking off the table any sense of power over a young person. So if I give you a gift in return, I expect you to do X. So it really takes that off of the table. So that was another important point.
And who you've recommended that these policies be developed. Who ideally would be the ones to develop these policies if it's going to happen?
The Legislative Council Committee, they review these recommendations. They can choose to adopt or not, but then they actually have human resources professionals on staff at the State House that will actually implement some of these recommendations.
And in your judgment, does the Kansas legislature have the right kind of professional staff on hand to do this work?
Absolutely. We felt very comfortable, confident with the experts that they have put into place. So I think they're well prepared to move this forward.
So if the policies that you're recommending do get adopted in coming months or years, who then would enforce them? Is this something where the legislature will end up having to police itself?
You know, it really depends on the direction that they choose to go. Currently, under the current structure, they do have, you know, a open door policy. So reporting to the legislators, specifically Senator Weigel has put out that she would be welcome to take any report. So yes, that would be currently, you know, their current structure. One of the recommendations is to actually offer and put into place outside counsel to review and to investigate any allegations so that it really keeps the protection of the victim and keeps the incident confidential and make sure that it is an independent investigation. So that is a recommendation that we brought forward.
And I know that's sort of part of the accountability section of your recommendations. How much does all of this cost? Is this something that Kansas is going to be able to just do by declaring it, or are they going to have to make some investment to make this work?
You know, that's a great question. What our recommendations are really with the infrastructure they already have in place with their staff. We don't see this being any cost. If any, it will be minimal to them. So it will be really just implementing, updating policies, procedures, and implementing practice. So that's the benefit of the recommendations.
Moving on in those recommendations, you devoted some significant space to education. Let me just ask you, generally speaking, what kind of education really helps when it comes to changing a culture around sexual harassment? You know, I'm an employee at UMKC here because I work at the radio station. I have to participate in these online webinars and click some boxes. Do I really understand sexual harassment from that kind of training, or do you need more than that?
Yes, great question. Something that we often field. The beauty and benefit of the training is really to get, first and foremost, a baseline of what sexual harassment is and what it isn't. But secondly, we feel that it's really important to talk about civility and respect in the workplace. And what the recommendation is, yes, it can be an online training, but we really encourage that it be a in-person training. The recommendation was it was a requirement for everyone that is essentially working in the state house go through a mandatory training. So that would include not only the elected officials, but also the employees, staff, as well as the interns and even the lobbyists that actually work there on a daily basis. So we think that by just getting the baseline, talking about the respect, how to interact and interface, what it is and what it isn't, is important to really change the culture.
I want to invite our listeners to the conversation. If you have questions for Wendy Doyle or thoughts about the culture of harassment that has been suggested to exist in the Kansas legislature, give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. We're also on Twitter at KCUR Up to Date. You talk about mandatory training, Wendy, for everybody who works in the state house, including the lawmakers themselves. I have to think requiring things of elected officials. If this were a business, you could discipline an employee, but you can't really tell the voters they elected the wrong person necessarily, right?
Right. But I do think it's important, when they are elected, they are not necessarily elected on how they interact with an intern. So I think it's extremely important that education occur so that everyone is, has a complete understanding of how we're going to interface and interact with one another.
The final section of your recommendations deals with victim resources. What does that mean?
So one of the things we felt very strongly about is the confidentiality so that it really protects the victim to come forward. I think you're really seeing that happen nationwide as a result of, the new climate and the new culture that is, being created. So there is that comfort level that victims can come forward and feel confident. There will be an independent investigation. There won't be retaliation against the victim. That's very important. We also put in a recommendation that some pro bono services perhaps could be offered, if appropriate, for legal counsel, for counseling services be offered to the victims. That was another, recommendation to bring forward as part of the harassment package.
What has been the initial response to these recommendations that at least has been communicated to you?
Yes. So the initial response was there when we presented this, a lot of head nodding. Of course, we were very thorough in our recommendations. Not only did we seek legal experts to advise us, but also experts in the harassment industry. But we also looked at other states and what their best practices were in addition to our work in Missouri. So I think the feedback has been they're pretty comprehensive. comprehensive. There is a lot of information. There is a lot of, you know, steps that could be taken. And again, the recommendation was, you know, this is long-term and, you know, looking at multi-years versus the most immediate. So I think the feedback has been extremely positive.
Has anything surprised you in this process? Things that you were not expecting to find or reactions you were not expecting to get?
I think the most surprising thing is, as we were doing this work, you know, what was unfolding on a national landscape. And the more that unfolded, the more that we saw some victims coming forward in Kansas. So I think that was the most surprising thing, that it was, you know, confirmation, if anything, that this is the right time, the right step, the right thing that the state of Kansas is doing, and that we hope that other states will follow suit.
Take us back a little bit to Missouri when you worked in the Missouri State House. You made these recommendations. You said you feel like there's been good results. What concretely came of that process?
Yeah, so most importantly for the interns and ombudsman was identified. So that's really a point person to really manage and provide support to the interns. What we've learned is that through that, there has been, you know, interns feeling comfortable coming forward to the ombudsman to really question and to ask, is this sexual harassment, maybe not reporting a case, but yet having a point person to do a test point. So I think that's been extremely important. Also, the mandatory training has worked extremely well.
So what you started to describe the kind of the mandatory training and what it might involve. Walk us through that. Like what would be the key three or four points that someone would come away from mandatory training with?
I think for us, again, the Women's Foundation doesn't actually do the training. We recommend that other experts actually provide the training curriculum and program. But the opportunity for questions to be asked, I think, is a real positive point from the policymakers, mm-hmm. again, of questioning what is and isn't considered sexual harassment. So, again, getting clarity on that definition. And then just being in the room with your colleagues and building that support and camaraderie, I think, was a real positive outcome for Missouri.
You know, I think one of the risks when you're dealing with a state house that maybe you don't deal with in a different kind of environment is politics. Do you feel like either in Kansas or Missouri or just generally today, this sexual harassment issue is being politicized? Are you concerned that it may become a partisan or a divisive issue rather than something people can agree on?
Right. We hope it doesn't. I think what we've worked really hard in Missouri is for it not to be. What we see now is early indication in Kansas is that, again, that everyone is collectively committed to changing the culture regardless of party, and that there is, you know, reaching across the aisle and wanting to work together to solve the issue. So I think we'll be pleasantly surprised with the outcome.
You've given your report. What's the role of the Women's Foundation going forward? Are you done now?
That great question. It's really in their hands now to adopt, to move it forward, to progress it. We will continue to be a resource in the evaluation and updating the policies, but really our hard work is done.
And are you, how confident are you from what you've seen so far that your work will be accepted, embraced, actually real energy, not just a box checked off?
Pretty confident, real commitment from leadership on both sides of the aisle, really seeing that this is a priority and something that everyone is committed to solving. So I think we're going to see some real progress.
Speaking more broadly than just the legislature, but with other groups you've worked with other situations you're aware of, what do you think are the barriers to change in an institution with an ingrained culture? I think we all agree, at least people would say they agree, sexual harassment is a bad thing, but actually changing a culture is a much more challenging thing. What are the barriers? Why isn't it easier?
Absolutely. You know, one of the solutions that we brought forward was if we had more women in leadership, that could really help combat sexual harassment. So that's something that we brought forward. So,
that's a message to voters, I guess.
Message to voters. It's a message to the corporate community as well. Having more women in leadership could reduce. We have seen that it can reduce sexual harassment in the workplace. So that is something that we brought forward. I really see a commitment from the top down. So really starting with that CEO level, those who are in leadership to really get behind and support, no tolerance, zero tolerance for sexual harassment in the workplace. So I think those are a couple of quick tools that you can take away that could be implemented.
You know, before we let you go, Wendy, I want to ask about kind of the other work of the Women's Foundation that you're working on right now. It's an important institution in Kansas City. It's been around for a good while. What are kind of your key projects that you're working on beyond working with a legislature when they happen to call you?
Yes, great question. So we're gearing up for legislative session. A couple of key things. We always invest in research, use our research to help us build out a policy platform. We have upcoming, we will be working on paid family and medical leave and looking at what we can do in Missouri and Kansas for that particular issue. So that's an example. I think finally is we have an appointments project. So we work to get women civically appointed to boards and commissions at the city, county, and state level, again, to try to build that pipeline so we can see more women elected and at the policymaking table.
Do you imagine 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, we're going to be in a different place as a society when it comes to matters of sexual harassment?
Absolutely. I think what we've seen, you know, on a national landscape, people coming forward, I think a real commitment to make change within the workplace. I think you'll see, everyone collectively, men and women, working together to reduce it. Absolutely. I think this is the moment in time and the momentum to get behind it, and we can really see that reduced.
And if there are people in the Kansas City area who want to be involved in that work or learn more about it, want to find resources themselves to deal with it in their workplaces or their communities, where do they turn?
Absolutely. You're welcome to visit our website at womens-foundation.org to learn more about our work that we've done in Missouri and Kansas and the recommendations that we made to the state of Kansas.
That's Wendy Doyle. She is president and CEO of the Women's Foundation, she works out of Kansas City, but has spent time in state capitals all across both states. Wendy, thank you so much for taking time with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Really has. You can listen to our podcasts and our previous programs at kcur.org/up-to-date. You can also catch the conversation we had earlier about poverty simulations in Kansas City. Don't forget, you can find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date, and I'm at PTS Brian. You can also follow KCUR on Facebook. On Monday, Steve Kraske will be back. He'll talk with psychologist Dr. Wes Crenshaw and a panel of young women about consent and the Me Too movement. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Kathleen Pointer. We had help this week from Linda Scher and Steven Steigman. It's been good to be with you all week. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date